From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, the country in the middle. Jordan is right between Iraq and Israel, and its politics reflect that uncomfortable position. We discuss Jordan with Milton Viorist, who writes about the Middle East for The New Yorker. Also today, Czech emigre Joseph Skvoretsky tells us what it's like to be put out of business by democracy. For 20 years, Skvoretsky published the works of banned Czech writers. Now that one of his writers is president of the country, Skvoretsky is ready to close down the press. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews three new specials about three old TV shows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraq today called on the UN Secretary General to condemn what it called the deliberate bombardment of a civilian air raid shelter in Baghdad. Iraqi officials claimed that almost 500 people were killed in the shelter. A UN spokesman said that Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar deplored the loss of civilian life, but stressed that he hadn't been able to verify the facts. Defense Secretary Dick Cheney said the shelter was actually a camouflaged military command and control bunker. Soviet talks in Baghdad on ending the Gulf War concluded today, but the discussions will continue in Moscow next week when Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz arrives there on Sunday. The BBC's Bridget Kendall has more.
The unexpected news that the Iraqi foreign minister is expected in Moscow soon was made in a brief announcement to journalists in Moscow by President Gorbachev's press spokesman. He said Mr. Tariq Aziz was due to arrive on Sunday and would probably have a meeting with President Gorbachev the following day. He said the Soviet president's special envoy to Baghdad, the senior Kremlin official, Yevgeny Primakov, had described his talks there with Saddam Hussein as encouraging. But there have been no further details to suggest any other progress at the talks, or that Saddam Hussein is any closer to agreeing to withdraw from Kuwait, still, according to Moscow, a necessary precondition for a settlement. But the Kremlin will be pleased that it can demonstrate Mr. Primakov's mission hasn't been entirely useless. By happy coincidence, according to the Soviet Foreign Ministry, the Kuwaiti Foreign Minister is also in Moscow this week.
The BBC's Bridget Kendall. Jordanian refugees said today that 30 people were killed and 24 wounded when Allied planes attacked the bus that was carrying them out of Kuwait. People who claimed to be survivors of the attack arrived today in Jordan. Other refugees, including people from the Sudan and Iran, also reported seeing attacks on buses and civilian traffic inside Iraq. They were unable to say if there were any casualties in those incidents. In Damascus, German Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher said Syria is ready to recognize Israel's right to exist in the Middle East's post-war order. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from London.
After more than 2 hours of talks with Syrian Foreign Minister Farouk al-Sharaa, Genscher told reporters in Damascus that Syria is aware that Palestinians' right to self-determination would mean that Israel's right to exist is recognized and secured. Genscher added that the Syrians said that after the Gulf War, Iraq's territorial integrity must be assured. The German foreign minister said the Syrians have a constructive view on the future post-war order in the Middle East, adding that Syria wants to play a major role in the process and that it expected Germany also to make a contribution. In London, this is Sylvia Poggioli.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 34 points today to close at 2,909. This is NPR News. The cholera epidemic in Peru is reported to have spread to another 2,500 people today and to have caused at least 77 deaths. Emergency medical aid arrived in Lima from Brazil, France, and at least a half dozen other countries. France provided a team of doctors, and Brazil sent medical supplies. Aid also came from UNICEF and the International Red Cross. Peru's health ministry said that more than 11,000 people have now been hit by the disease. Peruvians are being warned to boil their water and avoid eating raw seafood. Officials in Germany say that the U.S. Embassy in Bonn was fired on today, and left-wing Red Army faction guerrillas claimed responsibility for the attack. No injuries were reported. Deirdre Berger has this report.
The shots damaged a wall surrounding the U.S. Embassy complex on the Rhine River in Bonn. Police say the shots were fired from the opposite side of the river. German television reported that machine guns were used in the attack. There have been tightened security precautions at all U.S. installations in Germany since the beginning of the war in the Gulf. Several Arab terrorist groups have repeatedly threatened the past few weeks to carry out attacks on U.S. sites in Germany. German officials have also tightened security at locations of potential bombings, such as Frankfurt Airport and sites near U.S. bases in Germany frequented by GIs and their families. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger in Frankfurt.
German prosecutors said police found a letter near the site of the attack claiming it was committed by the Red Army faction in retaliation for the U.S. role in the Gulf War. Police said they believed the letter was authentic. Colombian officials said today that a cousin of President Cesar Gaviria was kidnapped. They said that Fortunato Gaviria was seized at his farm by four men armed with shotguns. The kidnapping occurred in a coffee-growing region about 125 miles west of Bogota. Security forces staged an operation in an area to prevent the kidnappers from escaping, but failed to find them. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Gulf War is changing U.S. relations with many of the countries in the Mideast. In some cases, the United States is forming new alliances with Arab countries. But in the case of Jordan, it finds itself at odds with an old friend. Jordan has recently been very critical of U.S. actions in the Gulf. Milton Viorst has written extensively about the Middle East. His 1989 book, Reaching for the Olive Branch, is about peace efforts in that region. Viorst recently spent a month in Jordan on assignment for The New Yorker magazine. He spoke about that country and the war in the Gulf with producer Pat Ford. Viorst says Jordan's King Hussein holds a special place in the Arab world.
What gives him a special stature is the fact that he is a descendant of Mohammed, that he is looked upon as having some sort of internal legitimacy in a region of the world where there is so very little legitimacy after all. You have to remember that this whole area of Arab habitation was recreated after the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1918. And as a result of this and the formation of nations which only exist by virtue of the British and French map drawers, the question of legitimacy is a very ticklish one. And King Hussein, at least, and this is substantial, has the advantage of having some lineage to go with, which is not the case with Saddam Hussein in Iraq or with Assad in Syria.
What have King Hussein's ties been with the U.S. traditionally?
Well, he has been the most moderate of the Arab leaders in an era when different countries turned from radicalism to moderation and back to radicalism in one thing or another as they have sought to establish an identity for themselves in this new land that became their independent countries. King Hussein has been rather consistent, as was his grandfather, of aligning himself with the Western powers. He felt comfortable with them. The king, after all, was educated in England. The country was basically given to his family by the British, and when the British pulled out of the region, he found no difficulty giving his allegiance to the United States. He also found it useful to be in some kind of relationship with the United States because of the ticklish problem of the border he has with Israel. The United States has not exactly been his protector, but it probably was more congenial to him to be under the umbrella of the United States than be under the umbrella of the Soviet Union, which was the other competing power in the region up until the end of the Cold War quite recently. And the king has been very faithful to this position, I think, from the very start, and has not wavered from it. And this whole crisis that has transpired, in which he finds himself aligned against the United States and on the side of the Iraqis, I think is a very difficult and uncomfortable one for him.
And so, how do you interpret his recent statements that have been so critical of the United States and have been greeted very poorly in the United States?
Well, King Hussein, I think you have to remember, is first and foremost an Arab. And if anything, his family represents the unity of what he calls the Arab nation, the standing up for the Arabs against the world. It is no contradiction for me to say that on the one hand, he feels comfortable aligning himself with the United States. But on the other hand, he feels that way in terms of his Arabism as a very strong Arab nationalist. And he said from the start that he was opposed to Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, and he did everything he could in the first few days to reverse it. But once the United States came in, it became too much a reminder of the old colonial powers interfering once more in affairs of the Arabs. And so he has very consistently, since the beginning of this crisis, said, yes, Saddam Hussein has got to get out of Kuwait, but yes, so does the United States have to get out of the region. It has no business there. This was a problem which could have and should have been worked out by the Arabs among themselves. Now, there's obviously been some dispute with that. President Bush has not felt that he was doing much of a job, but in effect, President Bush did not give him any time to do it. King Hussein, after the invasion of Iraq, after the invasion of Kuwait by the Iraqis, said, give me 72 hours, I think I can work this out. President Bush apparently said yes, and then about halfway through that, cut him off, and the opportunity for working this out in a diplomatic fashion then simply vanished and never reappeared.
Yeah, I think some American analysts have hinted darkly that he's doing this because he's in trouble domestically because of his large Palestinian population, and there is a large Palestinian population in Jordan. Do they really threaten King Hussein?
Well, there is a large Palestinian population in Jordan, but I think it's an oversimplification to think that he is doing it only for reasons of politics. Sure, in any system, the ruler has to, if he plans to survive, has to function in some harmony with his constituency, including King Hussein. But on the other hand, I think King Hussein himself feels very deeply about this, and I don't think that can be in any way overestimated. He is a committed Arab nationalist. He feels that the United States, along with its Western allies, should not be fooling around here on Arab territory, particularly since the Arabs themselves, in his judgment, could have solved this problem a lot better.
Mm-hmm. But the Palestinians in Jordan enjoy quite a comfortable life compared to the Palestinians in other Arab countries.
No question about it. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons he's so strong. I don't think, certainly since 1970, when there was a PLO revolt, the king has been threatened by any internal political forces. As a matter of fact, even in 1970, the reason he survived that so handily was that the Palestinians living in his domain, and they do make up more than 50%, decided they would back King Hussein rather than back the PLO when the PLO was attempting to take the country over. So I think it's a mistake to think that he is not popular. He has a very strong sense of how to accommodate himself to the needs of his Palestinian constituency and to keep his Palestinian and Jordanian constituencies in reasonable harmony. He's been pretty clever at this and feels very, very deeply that this is something that is an Arab prerogative and not a Western prerogative.
Since King Hussein has become more critical of the United States action in the Gulf, American officials have hinted that they're going to be reviewing aid to Jordan, that this may mean a cooling off of relations with Jordan. What would be the consequences to Jordan of this?
Oh, the consequences are huge. Jordan has already paid a very heavy price for what I might note is a rather faithful observance of the United States embargo against Iraq. Iraq was Jordan's biggest trade partner, and the entire Jordanian economy was very largely dependent upon trade with Jordan and with the powers of the Gulf, that is Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. And which has also been cut off for political reasons. The Saudis have not been very gracious about this, and of course Kuwait doesn't exist anymore. So in effect, more than one half of the GNP of Jordan has been eliminated. There was a huge influx of money coming in from the Gulf region, which is just no longer available. And if the United States also determines that it must cut out its small economic assistance program, why, that will be another blow. But the king indicated that he was prepared for this if he had to. He said what he felt he had to say, and he said it rather decisively. And he knows he is a man who has lived with disappointment throughout his life. He is a rather melancholy figure. I've had the fortune to meet him many times. He exudes a certain sincerity and at the same time a kind of a a frustration that he has not been able to end the problem of the Arab-Israeli conflict, that he has not been able to fulfill the mandate in very large measure passed on to him by his Hashemite heirs. But he is a determined man, and he is a good politician, and I think he will survive this.
Jordan is the most liberal democratic monarchy in the region. How is it working, their experiment with democracy?
So far, it seems to be working rather well, but they had a very successful election, an honest election. I am a little worried, and I think there's some good reason to be worried, that this current crisis is going to foster the fortunes of the non-democratic elements of the society, and by that I mean the Islamic fundamentalists. They won about 20% in the last election, substantially more than anybody anticipated, but they are growing stronger in Jordan as they are growing stronger on the West Bank among the Palestinians. And much of the reason is certainly this grievous disappointment with the United States. It has become, in very large measure, almost a fundamentalist versus America, and the more radical you can be, the more popular you are. So the moderates are suffering rather seriously throughout the entire region. And I think the right-wing Islamic radicals are thriving. And this, of course, is a threat to democracy, not just in Jordan, but in Egypt, too. And it is for any other country in the Arab world which is contemplating democracy. The same thing is true in Algeria. I think our policy, whatever its designated objective, is certainly working against those forces which are democratic and which we putatively would like to promote.
My guest is Milton Viorst, who covers Middle East issues for The New Yorker magazine. He lives in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Milton Viorst is my guest. He covers the Middle East for The New Yorker magazine. And you've covered the region extensively and for a long time. What do you think are the consequences of this war to a region that is so unstable?
Well, it's still not quite clear what they will be and will not be clear until the war is over. I think there's probably going to be a very big difference between what will happen if the war is short and if it's long. And if it's long and agonizing, I think all of these primeval forces that are brewing around the whole region will be strengthened. If it's over quickly and we move smartly, then perhaps the danger won't be quite as great. But the war is already almost a month old, so we are getting into the point where I think it will be embedded in the historical memory of the region. And I'm not at all optimistic about the way things will shape up. I don't think we have any idea how we are going to how Iraq will be governed after the war is over. For example, there are no democratic forces that we know of that are substantial waiting to take over. And I think even more important, it would be the death knell to any democracy to come in under the aegis of the conqueror. We know what happened in 1952 the United States, restored the Shah of Iran to the throne. He just became weaker and weaker in spite of the fact that we continue to furnish him with modern weapons. And gradually he fell to the medieval revolution of Khomeini. Well, I am quite fearful that that kind of thing can also happen in other parts of the region and certainly within the Arab world. We don't know, for example, in Iraq, whether the nation itself will stick together. Suppose the Kurds decide to break off, and there is an important Kurdish independence movement, as there has always been. There is also a Kurdish independence movement going on in Turkey, and suppose the two link up. It is quite possible there will be a war as the Turks, themselves move into Iraq and try to suppress the Kurds. I mean, the whole thing is just replete with all kinds of imponderables, none of which are very positive. I can't think of any of these imponderables that can turn out positively, and that's certainly one of the reasons that I am so opposed to this war. Unstable as the Middle East has been for so long, in my judgment, this war can only make it more so, no matter how it ends up.
In your articles for The New Yorker, you give full rein to Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz and Prince Hassan of Jordan, who explain quite sympathetically Saddam's decision to invade Kuwait. And that's just a view that's seldom acknowledged in the U.S. media. What don't we understand about the Iraqi point of view, and how has that guided or misguided our actions in the region?
Well, I think that I'm very troubled by what I feel has been a failure of the American press and the whole American learning process. We have allowed ourselves to be dominated, and by we, I mean the country and the press, by the president's agenda. The president has not seen fit to explain what he is doing within the context of the politics of the region. There was a very serious dispute going on between Kuwait and Iraq for 6 or more months prior to the invasion. It was a dispute in which there was no black and white. There was something right on both sides and something wrong on both sides. This is not by any means to defend Iraq's invasion of Kuwait, but Kuwait certainly was behaving, by the testimony of any observer who has looked at this closely, in an extremely provocative fashion. Some people think that it was behaving in this provocative fashion because it thought or did indeed have a certainty that the United States stood behind it. But the fact is that within the framework of this dispute, there was a huge amount of negotiating room. And if President Bush had said, no, we will not allow the invasion of Kuwait to stand, which is what he said. But at the same time, he said, look, I recognize that this is a serious dispute, and we will seek to act as mediator or try to get you two people to come together to work this out, because we recognize that this is not all black or all white. And I think we might have been successful.
You know that conspiracy theories are popular in the Arab world, but you seem to give a certain credence to one that says that Kuwait, with the collusion of the United States, provoked the Iraqi invasion. Why does that seem credible to you?
Well, it seems credible because there is some evidence there. I've heard dozens of conspiracy theories since I have been covering the Middle East, which is quite a long time now, and most of them are far-fetched, not to say bizarre. And I'm not even sure that I would call this a conspiracy theory. I hate to do that, only because it gets lumped together with all the other crazy conspiracy theories that we have been hearing for so long. But the fact is, as I suggested a few minutes ago, Kuwait, which is a very small country relative to Iraq, although extremely rich, continued over the course of a long period of time to provoke the Iraqis in areas of no apparent interest to itself. It would have been quite easy for the Kuwaitis to give some ground on things like oil prices and loans and the other areas of dispute. Most Arabs, and I'm not talking about Gaddafi and the screwball fringe of the Arab world, I'm talking about the central responsible fringe, King Hussein of Jordan, Mubarak, and others, could not understand why the Kuwaitis were behaving that way unless they thought that that they could get away with it because the United States would stop Iraq from acting. I think there may very well have been a decision on the part of perhaps not the State Department, perhaps some other agency of the government, to attempt to weaken Iraq economically for a variety of reasons having to do with oil and weapons and the rest. But there is, as I explained in great detail, I think, in my article in The New Yorker, a body of evidence which suggests that the United States was not quite as innocent in this whole affair as we subsequently pretended to be. Now, I do not say that I have found a smoking gun, but the absence of a smoking gun does not mean that there is not some awfully compelling information there which suggests some American collusion during the months preceding the Iraqi invasion.
Shortly after the August 2nd invasion of Kuwait, you went to Baghdad with Jesse Jackson. During your trip with Jesse Jackson, you had a chance to meet Saddam personally. What impressions did you leave with?
Well, I spent a couple of hours with him, but I can't tell you that he became an intimate pal or anything of that sort. He did not seem to me a man of brilliant intellect. Tariq Aziz, it seems to me, handles the language and the questions a lot better. You got the feeling about him that this was a tough and solid man. But between a couple of hours with him and what I know about his background, it just seems to me that this is a man who is far more complex than any oversimplified denunciation like the Butcher of Baghdad or the Hitler of our time or whatever the case may be leads us to believe. This is a man who is an offspring of the society into which he was born, and by which I mean he shares those values of suspicion and fear of a resurgence of colonial power in the region. He shares this sense of pride that Iraq is now free and will not be allow itself to be pushed around by a great power that seems to be giving out ultimatums and diktats and orders rather than treating Iraq with respect. He is a man who is insular and narrow and unsophisticated because of the background he has, but he is extremely nationalistic and extremely proud and has a very strong sense of what it is to be a free Iraqi in the 20th century. And some people, when they hear me say this, say, oh, you're just a terrible apologist. Well, the fact is, it seems to me we have a choice of depriving ourselves of any capacity for judgment by trying to simplify this man into merely a murderer and a despot, which he is, or we can look at him as having three dimensions. And I think it is incumbent upon us and important to us as Americans to look at who he is rather than the symbol of what the president has tried to make him. And I think it is unfortunate that we have really put this screen in front of our eyes. When I say we, I mean the American people in very large measure and the government, and attempted to deny the reality of a complex situation, both in terms of Saddam as a leader and Iraq as it is now in its place in history. The president wanted to reduce this problem to one of right or wrong. And yes, there was much right and wrong in it, but it was not the only considerations. And if he had looked at this, it seems to me, in terms of what his adversary saw and in terms of how his adversary perceived this whole thing, then I think, again, that this war could have been avoided and we could have achieved our objectives in Kuwait at the same time.
Milton Viorst covers Middle East issues for The New Yorker magazine, and he's the author of Reaching for the Olive Branch. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Pat Ford. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Joseph Skvoretsky fled Czechoslovakia after the 1968 Soviet invasion. From his new home in Toronto, he published the work of fellow émigré writers whose books, like his own, were banned in Czechoslovakia. Now that one of his writers is president of the country, Skvoretsky is going to close down the press. Coming up, Joseph Skvoretsky on the end of an era in censorship and underground publishing, an era he's glad to see come to an end. And over the next week, you have a chance to see the best of Mary Tyler Moore, All in the Family, and The Ed Sullivan Show. TV critic David Bianculli reviews all three upcoming specials. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Iraq has called on the UN Secretary General to condemn what it called a deliberate bombardment of a civilian air raid shelter in Baghdad. Officials in Iraq said that at least 500 civilians were killed in the shelter when it was hit by Allied bombs early this morning. U.S. officials say the structure housing the bomb shelter was also a military bunker used as a command and control facility. Alan Little of the BBC was taken to the scene by Iraqi officials.
As darkness fell tonight, we returned to the shelter. Rescue workers were still pulling bodies from the smoking shell. I watched stretcher after stretcher emerge from the darkness. Many bore the bodies of small children, others those of women. Some were badly burned. Others appeared uninjured and may have died of suffocation. This was a shelter that local people believed could withstand a nuclear blast. But last night, at 5-minute intervals, two Allied missiles, or bombs, had penetrated the 10 to 12 foot thick concrete roof. They'd exploded inside, the reinforced walls containing the full impact of the explosion. This morning we saw the charred and mutilated remains of those nearest the door. They were piled onto the back of a truck. Many were barely recognizable as human. I saw one man, incoherent with grief, fall to the ground and bury his face in the earth. 11 members of his family had been in the shelter.
Alan Little of the BBC in Baghdad. Refugees in Jordan have reported that an Allied missile struck a civilian bus in Kuwait, killing an estimated 30 people. NPR's John Burnett reports from Amman.
In the past 2 days, Jordanian refugees returning from Iraq have reported an air attack Saturday on two buses carrying Jordanians out of Kuwait. A Jordanian newspaper reported that 30 people were killed. An eyewitness was quoted by Reuters news agency today as saying one missile hit the road and the buses stopped. 25 people had scrambled out of the first bus, and 30 were still inside when it was hit by a second missile. The eyewitness said 4 children were among the dead. The second bus was not hit. 6 other refugees crossing into Jordan reported passing the burned bus and seeing 30 charred bodies still sitting inside. The Jordanian Red Crescent, the Arab equivalent of the Red Cross, has sent a medical team to Baghdad to investigate and bring back any wounded. Until it returns on Friday, a Red Crescent official said he could neither confirm nor deny the bus incident. In Amman, I'm John Burnett reporting.
According to diplomats, Saudi Arabia is seeking more than $3 billion in loans. The country is facing a budget deficit after pledging more than $48 billion to the Persian Gulf War. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 34 points to close at 2,909.16 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Government officials in Mexico say that more than 36 people were crushed to death at Ash Wednesday services at a church in the central part of the country. The deaths occurred as thousands of Roman Catholic pilgrims tried to cram into the church south of Mexico City. More than 25 others were injured in the crush. German Foreign Minister Genscher says that Syria is willing to recognize Israel's right to exist as part of a Middle Eastern peace settlement. He made the statement in Damascus after holding talks with the Syrian foreign minister. Patricia Golan in Jerusalem has more.
According to Foreign Minister Genscher, Syria is prepared to recognize Israel's right to exist as part of a general Middle East settlement, which would include the recognition of the Palestinians' right to self-determination. An advisor to Prime Minister Itzhak Shamir characterized the statement as a difference in tone but not substance, adding that he'd believe it when he heard it from the Syrians. Dr. Yossi Olmert, director of Israel's government press office and an authority on Syria, is also skeptical.
I'm not saying that we have to completely rule it out or dismiss it. But right now, if you ask me, my immediate instinctive reaction, let's wait and see. Don't hold your breath.
Israel's experience, says Dr. Olmert, that such messages are more effective when sent by the governments concerned. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
A Syrian government statement said that Syria's stance is not a major change and is still linked to a 1973 UN resolution that calls for an Israeli pullout from occupied Arab territories. Officials say a United Airlines jet on its way to San Francisco turned back to Tokyo after a passenger said that he had a bomb. The plane with 316 people on board landed 5 hours after taking off. No one was injured in the incident, and a 47-year-old man was questioned by police. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against most other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. After 20 years of publishing books by Czech writers banned in Czechoslovakia, Joseph Skvoretsky has decided to close down his small publishing company. After all, one of his writers is now president of the country. Books aren't censored anymore in Czechoslovakia. Skvoretsky and his wife Zadina Selivarova fled their country after the 1968 Soviet invasion. They moved to Toronto, where they founded the small press 68 Publishers. One of the banned Czech writers they published was Skvoretsky himself. Skvoretsky was in New York yesterday to receive an International Writers Award, so we invited him to talk with us about his decision to close down 68 Publishers. They plan to release their last book this Christmas.
Right after the Velvet Revolution, we thought that we would cease immediately, but then friends told us that we should continue and carry on. So we made a compromise. We decided that we will publish another 12 or 13 books as our final volume, and then we'll close it.
The world is so changeable. You know, I'm thinking just as you decide that, there's no more need for your Czech language publishing company. The Soviet Union is cracking down on the independence movement in the Baltics. Police and KGB activity is on the rise within the Soviet Union. Do you feel like things really haven't settled down yet, that you don't really know what the future will be in that part of the world?
Well, I feel quite strongly about Czechoslovakia and Poland and Hungary, you know. I don't think that the rule of the Communist Party can return to those countries because it would necessitate another Soviet invasion, and at the moment I don't think they are strong enough to do that. Then also don't forget that Germany was united, so they would have to invade part of Germany. So I think the situation in the former satellites is more or less secure, which doesn't mean that the remnants of the communist hardcore party, you know, the communist mafia, will do nothing will not sabotage the efforts of the democratic elements. It's hard times are ahead, of course, but I have full confidence in my people that they will master this problem.
One of the authors who you've published by your press is yourself. Your own books were banned in Czechoslovakia, so you had to be published in a more underground system. Are you available in Czechoslovakia now?
Yes, about four books of mine have already been published, and very successfully, if I may say so. For instance, I wrote a novel about, it's a satire on the communist army called the Tank Battalion. And that sold about 250,000 copies already, which is, of course, an immense number if you consider that there are only about 11 million Czechs. So it's a huge number. And another book of mine, which is in English, The Swell Season, sold about 200,000 copies. And they have already finished shooting a movie based on the tank battalion in Prague. And this will be the first Czech feature film after more than half a century, which was produced by a private company, not by the state company of Barrandov. So things are moving, and there are very many encouraging signs.
So your books that are published in Czechoslovakia and the books of other authors who you've published on 68 Publishers, are they coming out in new editions, or is it your editions of the books that are selling?
They are coming out in new editions because, you know, we were a shoestring business, so we, for instance, didn't have any editors. I edited the books myself, and I had to do so many other things that the editing was not done, you know, in a first-class way. So they now are being edited by professional editors who have all the time. But most of the books that we publish are now being republished in Prague in new editions, including the plays by Václav Havel, who is one of our authors, and now, of course, he is the president. So that's another encouraging sign.
Now that you will soon be closing down 68 publishers, are you dismantling the literary underground railroad that you created over the years?
Well, it's no longer necessary. We can now send manuscripts and books by mail, which was impossible before the change of November 1989. We had to smuggle everything, and everything had to be smuggled to us. Now we can use the mail and the courier service, so we are not dismantling it. It simply doesn't exist anymore because it's not necessary.
The last time we spoke, you gave us one example of how you smuggled books out of Canada into Czechoslovakia. I was wondering if you could give us another, if you could share some of the system that you created for getting books into the country.
Well, the system was not created by us, you know, that was created by other people and we used it. So there were some of the smugglers were professionals. At one time they even had a custom-built car which could accommodate about 50 volumes of paperback volumes and which traveled to Prague more or less regularly across the border, and it had this hidden compartment. But that's in the end, the police found out about it. You know, they had an informer in Austria, and he informed them about the car. So that on one of the crossings, the two people who were driving the car, a man and wife team, were arrested and the books were confiscated. So that ended. But then, of course, there were many German tourists who were willing to take a few copies into Czechoslovakia. And if they were caught, they just played, you know, the naive Westerner who simply has no idea that books are banned because they officially nothing is banned, you know. And then there were these old age pensioners who were permitted to visit their children in the West. The government, you know, let them go because they hoped they would stay here, and some of them did stay, but most of them returned because the people who stayed here, of course, lost their pensions, and they had to be supported by their children. So these people smuggled many books, and then we used various channels, you know, various willing diplomats, and so it was a very varied, you know, enterprise.
Sounds like a lot of the people who you used were just the kind of people who wouldn't look like they were smuggling anything.
No, certainly not. Most of them were amateurs.
Were you ever harassed in Toronto?
Well, so at the beginning of our endeavors in the publishing field, I had quite a lot of visitors from Prague who always phoned me. You know, these were the old age pensioners who were in Canada to visit their children. And they would phone me and tell me that they had a message for me from Mr. Havel or Mr. Kundera, who was then still in Prague, or from Mr. Vatsulik and from other friends of mine who were prominent among the dissidents, and whether they could see me. So I said, all right, come to my place. And they came to my place, and I developed a method. You know, I always gave them whiskey, and they were not very used to drinking hard liquor. So they very soon got a little inebriated. And then they told me that that was the precondition of getting a permission to visit their children, that they would seek me out and ask me to send some messages to Havel and to these people through them. Of course, I didn't send any messages because I knew that they would have to report it to the secret police. But otherwise, I was never harassed.
So it sounds like the government was using people who didn't look like they were spies either.
Yes, yes.
You were both playing the same game.
Yes. They simply told them, well, all right, if you want to visit your children in Toronto, you have to do something for us. There is this publishing house, and we are interested in, you know, finding out about their, you know, financial situation, and perhaps they would be willing to send a message to Havel. So my messages were invariably, hello, you know. I never went beyond saying, well, say hello to Mr. Havel. so I wasn't that naive.
My guest is Czech emigre writer and publisher Joseph Skvoretsky. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Joseph Skvoretsky is my guest. Have you been back to Czechoslovakia recently?
Yes, I was there last spring in May. And that was a very... It's hard to describe because it felt more like a dream, not so much as reality, because, you know, after 20 years, and we never expected that this would happen in our lifetime, we were quite, you know, convinced that we would simply end our days here without having a chance to visit the old country. So it felt like a dream. And everybody was very nice to us, and we had many signing sessions, you know, with our readers, and thousands of people lined up and brought the old pre-invasion books that I had published, and all the books that they copied on their typewriters, and I signed them. Many of them brought books that I had already signed in the 60s. Now they wanted me to sign them again in the 80s, you know. So we met old friends. It was just a great time.
When you were in Czechoslovakia, I wonder if you went to hear any music. I ask that because music has always been an important part of your life and an important subject of your writing.
Yes, well, my many friends who are jazz musicians and pop singers and pop musicians and rock and roll musicians organized a big concert for us in the Lucerna Hall in Prague. The Lucerna Hall is something like Carnegie Hall, you know. And it can seat about 4,000 people, and it was packed. And the concert was called For the Skvoretskys Finally at Home. So it was done in our honor, and everybody who means anything in jazz music and pop music was there. So that was very nice. And we also visited a nightclub where Emil Wiklitsky was performing. Wiklitsky is at the moment the best Czech jazz pianist. He's a graduate of the Berklee School of Music in Boston. And so they performed for us. They even brought in a bass saxophone and asked me to play it, which I couldn't because I've never played a bass saxophone, you know. So but it was that was one of the best aspects of my stay in Prague, or many musicians and singers and old friends.
Yeah, one of your novellas is called The Bass Saxophone, and the story is in part about the kinds of music that the Nazis outlawed because it was considered too,
Judeo-Negroid.
Yes, right, Judeo-Negroid, yeah. So that was the reason for the bass saxophone tribute.
Yes.
I guess... Is that novel one of the most popular of your books in Czechoslovakia?
Well, it's very popular among the musicians, you know, because I've had so many letters from not only Czech musicians, but American musicians like Gary Mulligan and various other people who read it, because it's about jazz, you know, so it appeals to jazz musicians. But as for my other novels, my most popular novel in Czechoslovakia is The Tank Battalion and The Cowards, which is also in English.
Those are both about the invasion?
No, The Cowards is about the end of the war, the last week of World War II in a small town. And that's the novel that introduced Danny Smiritsky and his friends who play jazz, you know. So that's a very popular novel. It was banned when it was originally published. It was banned and seized by the police. And I was fired from my job because of that novel. Which was, of course, excellent publicity. Everybody wanted to read it. So these two, I think, are the most popular novels of mine in Czechoslovakia. Because, you know, The Miracle Game and The Engineer of Human Souls have not yet been published in Czechoslovakia. They are very long novels, and it takes some time, and, of course, costs a lot of money to publish such long novels.
Did you meet friends who were writers who were trying to figure out what to write about now that perhaps their subject would no longer be the communist bureaucracy?
Well, I don't think that's the problem with the Czech writers. They always have lots of things to write about. Because don't forget that for the writers who stayed at home, were not permitted to write on the burning issues. And, you know, the totalitarian regime creates so many absurd situations that you never run out of stuff. You can just spend a lifetime writing things like Kafka or like Havel, you know.
When books were banned in Czechoslovakia, writers took on a certain heroic status because it was really an act of bravery to write something that was going to possibly get you in a lot of trouble. Do you think writers will maintain that kind of heroic status now that you're free to write or say anything in the country?
Well, I hope they won't pose as heroes because that's unhealthy. You know, writers should be writers and they should concentrate on writing well. And the heroism was necessary at a certain time, or some sort of heroism. That's no longer necessary because now there is no censorship. And nobody can really get into trouble because of writing a novel, unless you have, of course, a libel law or something like that. But certainly not for political reasons, which was usually the case, where in my first novel, The Cowards, I was in trouble because the political interpretation of that novel was that it was slanderous of the Red Army, which it wasn't, but that's how the party interpreted it, and I was in trouble. So such thing can no longer happen in present-day Czechoslovakia.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
Writer and publisher Joseph Skvoretsky, a novel he wrote 20 years ago, The Miracle Room, has just been published in the U.S. by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, do you have more on the Iraqi bomb shelter that was hit by U.S. missiles?
We do. We'll have a report from a BBC correspondent who's in Baghdad and who witnessed the scene as rescue workers were really pulling bodies out of that site, and as residents of the neighborhood, men were identifying their mothers, wives, children who'd been inside. U.S. military briefers and other allied officials say that facility was a command and control center. There may have been others using it, but that there was some military use to that target, insisted they did, that it was a proper target for action.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Over the next week, CBS is airing three specials celebrating some of the network's classic shows from the past. On Saturday, Norman Lear hosts the All in the Family 20th Anniversary Special. On Sunday, Carol Burnett hosts the very best of The Ed Sullivan Show. And on Monday, the cast of The Mary Tyler Moore Show is back for its 20th anniversary. TV critic David Bianculli has reviews of all three.
It isn't that CBS is waxing nostalgic all of a sudden. It's just that this is the closest three-way ratings race in TV history. And in this key sweeps month, every hour counts. Since CBS has so few good shows now, why not just reach back into the past and tap the memories and the potential viewership of some of their best shows of the past? But the ends, in this case, justify the motives. Each of these three shows is structured in a slightly different way, and for slightly different reasons, each is well worth watching and taping. The All in the Family special mixes cast interviews with remarks from everyday viewers who loved or hated the show all those years ago. The viewers aren't very revealing, but the clips are. Some of them are as intentionally abrasive today as they were then, especially the fights between Carol O'Connor's Archie Bunker and Rob Reiner's Meathead. To me, though, the most memorable moment comes when Archie explains his ideas about war, ideas which, even today, aren't very easy to accept.
Well, you think the whole people of this country can say whether or not they want to go to war? You couldn't get a decent war off the ground that way. All the young people would say no, sure they would, because they don't want to get killed. And that's why we leave it to the Congress, because them old crocs ain't going to get killed. And they're going to do the right thing and get behind the president and vote yes.
In the Ed Sullivan tribute, there are no everyday viewers in sight. Just lots of clips and a handful of performers looking back on them. Ray Manzarek of The Doors, for example, looks back at the group's 1967 appearance.
Some representative from network television came into our dressing room half hour before showtime And we looked at him, and he said, "Boys, we've got a problem." And we all looked at each other and said, "Oh, man, now what?" You cannot, on network television, say the word hire.
Now the Doors, here they are with their newest hit record.
And I jumped up and said, okay, fine, we'll think of something. We'll think of something. Don't worry, there's no problem. Whoever it was from Network came backstage afterwards and started to scream at us. "But you promised you wouldn't say higher." And then I went into my routine. "Well, look, sir, you know, we were just so excited. It's the Ed Sullivan Show. We're just kids. We're so nervous. We didn't know what we were doing. We've done it this way 1,000 times. And we're sorry we said the word higher." And he said, "Well, you promised you'll never work the Ed Sullivan Show ever again." And then Morrison, in classic Jim Morrison fashion, looked at the guy and said, "Hey, man, we just did the Ed Sullivan Show."
These insider stories and some well-chosen full-length performances make the show fun to watch. The best-constructed retrospective show of all, though, is the one for the Mary Tyler Moore Show, hosted by Mary herself.
Good evening. I'd like to invite you to join me for a very special reunion. 20 years have passed since that first Saturday night when Mary Richards threw her hat in the air. Tonight, I've gathered everyone together again to celebrate and remember the joy, the fun, and the love our family of performers and creators shared.
Come on already. Can we see the tapes?
Let's get this show on. Let's stop it, Mary.
Except for the late Ted Knight, the gang's all here. And the clips shown are lengthy, well-chosen, and very, very funny. Watch the Mary Tyler Moore 20th Anniversary Show for the comedy, the very best of the Ed Sullivan Show for the variety, and the All in the Family 20th Anniversary Special for the sociology. It's a look back at a time when CBS's shows were great instead of grating.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Vablaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Fresh Air is directed by Chris Spurgeon. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we look at the international law on the treatment of prisoners of war with Alfred Rubin, a professor of international law at Tufts University. And we meet British actor Robbie Coltrane. He co-starred in Nuns on the Run, Henry V, and Mona Lisa, and now he stars in the new movie Perfectly Normal. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.